of the material world. So that's what we were kind of discussing yesterday. We left off by hearing how the demons in the lower heavenly regions are generally householders, because it's kind of the biggest sense and joy as a renunciate. Acharya Nishtha pointed out, he said, if you're renounced, who do you enjoy with? You just enjoy by yourself. And so to be in intense sense and joy requires a household. Of course, we thought afterwards, but you could be like a bachelor and be a great enjoyer, a bachelor demon. Anyway, so this is what we were hearing about so far, the lower planetary regions. We left off with the demons living, being so absorbed in illusory engagements of wife, children, friends, society, etc. And in Prabhupada's purport, that the Vaishnavas feel very compassionate towards such persons and therefore try to assist them or relieve them from such material engagements. So now we're going to text 9. Generally, I'm just going to be reading. A lot of it is just the verses, and sometimes there's purports. And I'll just read them, and I think the descriptions are rather self-evident. So if anyone has any questions, you can just ask. Otherwise, I'm going to continue to read. And maybe we can finish a chapter within a few days. So this is text number 9. My dear King, in the imitation heavens known as Bila Swarga, there is a great demon named Maya Dhanava, who is an expert artist and architect. He has constructed many brilliantly decorated cities. There are many wonderful houses, walls, gates, assembly houses, temples, yards, and temple compounds, as well as many hotels serving as residential quarters for foreigners. The houses for the leaders of these planets are constructed with the most valuable jewels, and they are always crowded with living entities known as Nagas and Asuras, as well as pigeons, parrots, and similar birds. All in all, these imitation heavenly planets are most beautifully situated and attractively decorated. Anyone wants to go to the lower planetary region? They have pigeons there, it looks like. Next verse. The parks and gardens in the artificial heavens surpass in beauty those of the upper heavenly planets. Yeah, so again, yeah, I told you, shocking information, right? That's why I said it helps to really blur the difference between piety and piety. Because to be a demon, you have to be rather impious, but here it seems that they're enjoying quite nicely. That should help us get a little perspective about the position of material sense enjoyment also. The trees in those gardens embraced by creepers bend with a heavy burden of twigs with fruits and flowers, and therefore they appear extraordinarily beautiful. That beauty could attract anyone and make his mind fully blossom in the pleasure of sense gratification. Fully blossom in the pleasure of sense gratification. There are many lakes and reservoirs with clear, transparent water, agitated by jumping fish, and decorated with many flowers such as lilies, kuvalayas, kahlaras, and blue and red lotuses. I don't know what those things are. Pairs of chakravakas and many other water birds nest in the lakes and always enjoy in a happy mood, making sweet, pleasing vibrations that are very satisfying and conducive to enjoyment of the senses. Hearing such descriptions could be slightly dangerous if you're too neophyte. Since there is no sunshine in the subterranean planets, time is not divided into days and nights, and consequently, fear produced by time does not exist. Many great serpents reside there with gems on their hoods, and the effulgence of these gems dissipates the darkness in all directions. Since the residents of these planets drink and bathe in juices and elixirs made from wonderful herbs, they are free from all anxieties and physical diseases. They have no experience of gray hair, wrinkles, or invalidity. Their bodily lusters do not fade. Their perspiration does not cause a bad smell. No need for deodorant, business shops and all. And they are not troubled by fatigue or by lack of energy or enthusiasm due to old age. They live very auspiciously and do not fear death from anything but death's established time, which is the effulgence of the Sudarshan chakra of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this one has a purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. This is the defect of material existence. Just in case you weren't thinking that way. This is the defect. Just in case you were thinking another way. This is the defect of material existence. Everything in the subterranean heavens is very nicely arranged. There are well-situated residential quarters, there is a pleasing atmosphere, and there are no bodily inconveniences or mental anxieties. But nevertheless, those who live there have to take another birth according to their karma. Persons whose minds are dull cannot understand this defect of a materialistic civilization aiming at material comforts. What is that defect? Yeah, it's death. Death is still involved, despite the amazing comforts. One may make his living conditions very pleasing for the senses, but despite all favorable conditions, one must in due course of time meet death. The members of a demoniac civilization endeavor to make their living conditions very comfortable, but they cannot check death. The influence of the Sudarshan chakra will not allow their so-called material happiness to endure. So they say this is the ultimate defect, that is not enduring. So proportionate to the degree of attachment to that which does not endure, then to that degree, that attachment becomes the actual source of misery. Right? Just like, so someone may say, we may say material things are all temporary. And someone may say, oh, but that makes me very happy. So then we question it, well, how happy does it make you? And if they say, it makes me very, very happy, then to that degree they actually have to suffer because it doesn't endure. So to the degree that we're attached to anything that does not endure, to that degree we have to suffer. Or to that degree that something becomes the very source of misery. Or Krishna's saying, dukkha yonaya evate, it becomes the womb which gives birth to misery, the son of misery, so to speak. So then, this is the great defect of material existence. Krishna says dukkhalayam, which means it's a house of misery. But oftentimes, dull-headed as we are as conditioned souls, we don't appreciate that feature of material existence. So we may say, oh, it is very nice. So then Krishna says ashashvatam. Even if you say it is very nice, it doesn't endure. It's temporary. And therefore, this is the great defect of material existence. But it's hard to realize. It's hard to appreciate. Isn't it? It's hard to appreciate. However temporary something is, it's hard to appreciate it. It's just like saying the pizza is temporary. That doesn't mean that we don't appreciate how wonderful it gives us pleasure at the present moment. Right? Because it doesn't manifest its temporary nature when we're enjoying it. And therefore, it's really hard to appreciate this defect of material existence. It requires profound realization. In fact, Krishna says the Mahatmas realize this, right? In that verse. How does it start? Mam upetya konteya, how does it start? That verse, 8:15, Bhagavad Gita. Mama upetya, huh? Yes. Then, nabnuvanti mahatmanaha. The Mahatmas actually realize this, great souls. Those who are mahatmanaha, big-minded or broad-minded persons, they actually realize this, not everyone. So next verse, this is text 15. When the Sudarshan disc enters those provinces, the pregnant wives of the demons all have miscarriages due to fear of its effulgence. My dear king, now I shall describe to you the lower planetary systems one by one, beginning from Uttala. In Uttala, there is a demon, the son of Maya Dhanava, named Bala, who created 96 kinds of mystic power. Some so-called yogis and swamis take advantage of this mystic power to cheat people even today. Simply by yawning, the demon Bala created 3 kinds of women known as Swairini, Kamini, and Pumshchali. The Swahilinis like to marry men from their own group. The Kaminis marry men from any group. And the Pumshalis change husbands one after another. Hare Krishna. If a man enters the planet of Atala, these women immediately capture him and induce him to drink an intoxicating beverage made with a drug known as Hataka, Cannabis Indica. I don't know if that's supposed to help us out. What the drug is. This intoxicant endows the men with great sexual prowess, of which the women take advantage for enjoyment. A woman will enchant him with attractive glances, intimate words, smiles of love, and then embraces. In this way, she induces him to enjoy sex with her, to her full satisfaction. Because of his increased sexual power, the man thinks himself stronger than 10,000 elephants and considers himself most perfect. Just because of his sexual prowess. Indeed, illusioned and intoxicated by false pride, he thinks himself God, ignoring impending death. So, anyone wants to go to Atala? Yeah.
Yeah. So, what is the qualification to go there? I mean, you were telling that by hearing this, we may feel that the difference between piety and impiety is blood. But if anybody wants to enjoy anything in this material world, he should have some pious deeds, right?
That's the general understanding.
Yeah, so...
Well, Krishna uses the word in Bhagavad Gita, for example, nama duskritino muta. So the word duskriti, the word kriti means meritorious activity. And then duskriti means he misuses the result of that meritorious work. So an example would be like Hiranyakashipu. He did something very meritorious in the form of tapasya, but he used the results of that tapasya for something douche, some fault, some improper activity. So it doesn't necessarily mean that piety alone can get you facility for enjoyment, but some type of meritorious activity. Tapasya, in a sense, you can say it's piety, but it's not exactly like piety as we ordinarily might think of it, like digging wells or doing some good acts for others and so on. But like tapasya, for example, might get you the result of some type of facility by which you can enjoy, like in the case of Hiranyakashipu. And then that meritorious work is used improperly. So Krishna describes these types of persons in the Bhagavad Gita, the duskritis. So how to get here? I don't know. I don't remember the previous chapters in terms of how to... Of course, that information isn't really important for us either as... aspirants of pure devotion as such. But the idea is that perhaps some meritorious activity is performed by which they gain some type of facility. But due to their demoniac nature, they're placed in a certain situation, a certain environment, and by which their demoniac nature is given full expression, like this Bila Swarga that we're hearing about and so on.
So another question is even if somebody wants to enjoy, let's say, a family life or anything in this world, how can being demoniac or a demoniac culture can lead to such an enjoyment? For example, even if we see US, it has so many material enjoyments in the sense, so many facilities, but still people are not happy. Even though there may be so many things, because they are not following the instructions of God. So how by not following the instructions of God, one can still enjoy?
Yeah, of course this is true in the earth region. But the idea, I think, that is a little subtle is that as conditioned souls, a householder's situation may be inherently demoniac. That's kind of what we discussed yesterday. That the tendency, for example, why did Shastra speak more antagonistically towards householder existence than positively? There are positive statements in the Shastras, but there's an overwhelming amount of negative statements. And why is that the case? That's because the tendency is to move towards the negative side, which means just absorption and taking care of the family and et cetera. So in other words, that type of activity is itself inherently defective. We'll use that word. We won't say demoniac, but we'll say that mentality of just absorption and taking care of the family, et cetera, is the defect. That's the inherent defect. And wrong mentality as such, a mentality shared by demons or those who are not godly. So that's the kind of the idea that we discussed yesterday. So therefore, you just like evil really doesn't exist as a separate entity. It's the absence of good, as we say like that. Ignorance is the absence of knowledge, for example. So these don't exist as like separate entities as such. So someone may be doing householder life very nicely, but just not cultivating God consciousness. So these demons, they may be living nice householder existences, you know, properly attentive to social etiquettes, etc., but just not cultivating God consciousness. Because essentially in the Shastras will describe all these things in relationship to the Absolute so that it can be spiritually progressive. So the demons could take the aspects which are nice for material life, but not the part that's in relation to the Absolute. And therefore, they enjoy nicely, but they don't make spiritual progress. And ultimately, it doesn't endure, which is the main defect that we just heard about. Like this. So this is all I can say on that particular point. Now, the evil or the demoniac nature that's exhibited is just the fact that they don't do these things in relationship to God. Right? That's the point. So also to the degree that we also enter into such situations, but we do not do those things in relationship to the Absolute. To that degree, that's the demoniac mentality that we're hearing about now. So like that, this is all I can say without having looked at the section elaborately. For more, anyone wants to contribute to that? Did you have something you wanted to mention? No? Anyone? Well, I don't know. Death sounds like death. What do you mean by death?
They don't die. They usually come when the fire security is over, they fall down as a drop of water or something like that.
Okay.
So how is it?
I don't know, but I don't know. But in all cases, death is fearful. So even for the devatas, when they die, when the results of their piety are exhausted, and they come down, they're always actually afraid of that. And so the point is that death is fearful. So it's fearful for everyone, even for those who are enjoying life nicely, but then Sudarshan is coming, so they become fearful. So how is death? It's fearful. How people die particularly? I don't know. I don't know. So if you're interested in that information, we can examine it a little bit closer. But that's like saying, did they die by being burned alive or did they die by drowning? You know, what difference does it make? And when death is death, it's fearful condition. It's not desirable. Like that. Okay, so we heard about Atula. So the next planet, this is the next verse. The next planet below Atula is Vitala, wherein Lord Shiva, who is known as the master of gold mines, lives with his personal associates, the ghost, and similar living entities. Lord Shiva, as a progenitor, engages in sex with Bhavani, the progenitress, to produce living entities, and from the mixture of their vital fluid, the river named Hatiki is generated. When fire, being made to blaze by the wind, drinks of this river and then sizzles and spits it out, it produces gold called Hataka. The demons who live on that planet with their wives decorate themselves with various ornaments made from that gold. And thus they live there very happily. So it just sounds like a good time, huh? That's demoniac. As Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, what is that verse? Avritam jnana etena jnaninas nitya verena kamarupena kontaya duchparena ananlanacha. Krishna is describing the effects of lust. And he says that the living entity's knowledge is covered by his eternal enemy in the form of lust. Nitya Verina means his eternal enemy, Kama Rupena in the form of lust. So Nitya Verina means the eternal enemy of the soul. And Prabhupada describes in the purport, which I always love this point, that eternal enemy is that feel-good feeling that you get from contacting sense objects. That feels good. That feeling is the eternal enemy of the soul. You know, that makes me happy. That gives me a sense of sensual pleasure. So that is the eternal enemy, you know. So whenever we get into that mode, of course, you know, with prasad and other things, you know, we can say it's transcendental and so on. But as a general point, that is the eternal enemy. That feels good. That mentality is the eternal enemy. So and it keeps them bound up. So in this way, if we understand that point, if we can appreciate that point, then this description is not very nice. But when we don't appreciate that point, then this description sounds like, hey, it doesn't seem too bad. You know, the lower planetary system is kind of nice. But once you understand that the feel-good feeling is actually keeps the soul bound up, then this is a very scary description that we're hearing about. Frightful indeed, isn't it? Okay, so here's a purport to the verse. It appears that when Bhava and Bhavani, Lord Shiva and his wife, unite sexually, the emulsification of their secretions creates a chemical which, when heated by fire, can produce gold. That's, wow, interesting, huh? It is said that the alchemists of the medieval age tried to prepare gold from base metal. And Srila Sanatana Goswami also states that when bell metal is treated with mercury, it can produce gold. Srila Sanatana Goswami mentions this in regard to the initiation of low-class men to turn them into brahmanas. Sanatana Goswami said, Yata kanchanatam yati kam syam rasavidha nataha tata adiksha vidhanena dvijatvam jayate nirnam. Quote, as one can transform kamsa, or bell metal, into gold by treating it with mercury, one can also turn a low-born man into a brahmana by initiating him properly into Vaishnava activities. That's the end of the quote. The International Society for Krishna Consciousness is trying to turn malechas and yavanas into rural brahmanas by properly initiating them and stopping them from engaging in meat-eating, intoxication, illicit sex, and gambling. One who stops these four principles of sinful activity and chants the Hare Krishna Mahamantra can certainly become a pure brahmana through the process of bona fide initiation, as suggested by Srila Sanatana Goswami. Apart from this, if one takes a hint from this verse and learns how to mix mercury with bell metal, takes a hint, by properly heating and melting them, one can get gold very cheaply. For all those interested in gold, take a hint. The alchemists of the medieval age tried to manufacture gold, but they were unsuccessful, perhaps because they did not follow the right instructions. What a purport. So Prabhupada took the opportunity to slip in a little transcendental information in there. Yeah. Yes, but it doesn't have destructive effects. So that is the advantage of spiritual existence, that there is feel-good feeling in the spiritual world, but everything there is absolute. The feel-good feeling here keeps us bound to illusion. So the feel-good feeling is not substantial. It is illusory. So then it binds us to something illusory and not enduring. At least one who doesn't appreciate that it's illusory, at least we can appreciate that the feel-good feeling binds us to something that will not ultimately endure. And in that sense, it is the source of our misery, for sure, certainly. Isn't it? Just like if you have like a relationship with the opposite sex or something, and there's a lot of feel-good feelings that come up, but ultimately that relationship will not endure. At best, it will be finished at death. Usually within months, but best case, nowadays at least, but best case scenario at death. So to the degree that feel-good feeling attaches us to something that will not endure, that feel-good feeling becomes a source of our misery, and therefore Krishna describes it as an enemy, like that. So we can at least appreciate that, yeah. He wants the microphone.
Yes, I understand that Lord Shiva is considered one of Krishna's like best devotees.
Sure.
He's like a pure Vaishnava. So how does he like kick it with like ghosts and these demonic beings? If he's
he doesn't kick it with them, he shows compassion to them. So that is described in the third canto. That Lord Shiva's kindness is that he shelters living entities that others would not give shelter to. Who would shelter ghosts and hobgoblins and all these things like that, gremlins and so on? You know, Lord Shiva's, so Prabhupada describes it as his broad-minded Vaishnavism, that he would shelter living entities that others would not dare to shelter. So it is his kindness, and not that exactly that he's kicking it with them as such.
Thank you.
You want to say something?
Just in regards to the last point, Naraktak's question, that also just relatively speaking, that the happiness of material sense gratification compared to spiritual happiness is so distinct. I mean, it's explained that among all types of material happiness, far superior to that, it's the happiness of Brahmananda. And we hear a description from Bhagavad Gita, the happiness of Brahmananda, if multiplied by 1 trillion-fold, doesn't even equal the fraction of bliss of pure devotion.
The things about those types of statements is we're not yet experiencing that Brahmananda even, what to speak of the Premananda. And so what we do know is the so-called Ananda of the material world. So with this type of explanation, that is nice support for our intellect to keep our intelligence properly focused. Therefore, we call sadhana bhakti buddhi yoga. That's how Krishna refers to yoga. In general, the idea is that Krishna establishes in the Bhagavad Gita that consciousness is different from matter. But in order to realize that, the process of yoga, in a generic sense, is required. But then he calls it as buddhi yoga. So depending on how you focus your buddhi, then you're either a karma yogi, a jnana yogi, a ashtanga yogi, a bhakti yogi, depending on where you're the focus of your intelligence. So these types of statements can help give our intelligence a little bit perspective. But because we may be lacking the experience of Brahmananda or Premananda, the Ananda in the material world is all we, the so-called Ananda in the material world is all we know. And therefore, we generally hear, because we're convinced about that, like those persons who have participated in sex and so on, we're already convinced about the happiness of the material world. But because we have some experience of the misery of it also, therefore we get the hunch that maybe this is not the all in all. And therefore that directs our intelligence towards the transcendence. But because we have yet to experience transcendental happiness, we don't have anything really to compare it to yet. Except for the fact that we're miserable, we know that those things are miserable or they lead to misery. And therefore we direct our intelligence towards something hopefully more substantial. It means hopefully in the sense that we have faith that it is more substantial. But until you gain that experience, you might not be 100% convinced, 100%. And therefore we need to always reinforce our intelligence by the process of hearing and discussing. At least, the very least, discussing the defects of material existence, which have convinced us to go for the hunch that there's something greater. You know, the something greater is usually based less on our great experience and of transcendental happiness as such, as it is based more on our frustration with material existence and the subsequent hunch that this is not the all in all that comes from that frustration. Does that make sense? So it's, you know, material happiness is very convinced. How many of us are still convinced by material happiness? You know, so, you know, we like to say that we're not, but, you know, there's a reason we don't go to the bars at night, right? It says when you see Lord Nityananda going into the bar at night, he's going to preach. And if you see us going to the bar at night, please come after me. You know, because there's a good chance I might not make it out because we're still convinced by the material energy. That's why it's very powerful. Yeah.
So is it possible for these jivas that are on these like lower heavenly planets to like advance, or are they perpetually stuck?
Well, no one's perpetually stuck in any situation, thanks to material nature. Material nature keeps material nature is kind enough to keep moving us, shuffling us around the whole material existence. I like Warren Maharaj's image of the fair, what do you call it, merry-go-round, and Maharaj made You know, this is actually, and this is exactly what the material world is. It's just really shuffling us around the same redundant program that we've been doing since time immemorial. That's all it really is. It only looks like very variegated, but actually the material existence is shuffling us around the same hacking experiences that we've had since, you know, time without beginning. And so luckily no one's perpetually in any one situation, you know, thanks to material nature. It keeps moving us around. So they'll get opportunity again to take human forms and so on, certainly. At that time, they need the association of saintly persons to get out of this vicious cycle of traveling, Brahmanda Brahmite, traveling, wandering the whole material cosmos. Probably even less than that, but yeah, just to give us an idea. Okay. Anything else? Okay, so the alchemist didn't perhaps follow the right instructions. That's where we left off in the last report. Next verse. We'll go a little bit longer here. How many verses is this chapter? I think it's like 31, so I won't be able to finish it today like I kind of hoped. Maybe. Let's see. Translation. Below the planet Vitala is another planet known as Sutala, where the great son of Maharaj Virochana, Bali Maharaj, who is celebrated as the most pious king, resides even now. For the welfare of Indra, the king of heaven, Lord Vishnu, appeared in the form of a dwarf brahmachari as the son of Aditi and tricked Bali Maharaj by begging for only 3 paces of land, but taking all the 3 worlds. Being very pleased with Bali Maharaj for giving all his possessions, the Lord returned his kingdom and made him richer than the opulent king Indra. Even now, Bali Maharaj engages in devotional service by worshiping the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the planet of Sutala. This is a purport by Srila Prabhupada. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is described as Uttama Shloka. He who is worshipped by the best of selected Sanskrit verses. That's interesting. I would take it that if you glorify God in English, that would also count as Uttama Shloka, provided it's coming from the heart. But anyway, Prabhupada says there's Sanskrit verses. And his devotees, such as Bali Maharaj, are also worshipped by Punya Shloka, verses that increase one's piety. Nice. That's a nice I got that one. When you hear about devotees, it's called Punya Shloka. It increases one's piety. Bali Maharaj offered everything to the Lord, his wealth, his kingdom, and even his own body. Sarvatma Nivedana Bali. The Lord appeared before Bali Maharaj as a Brahmana beggar, and Bali Maharaj gave him everything he had. However, Bali Maharaj did not become poor. So just in case you're worried about that idea of giving everything now. By donating all his possessions to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he became a successful devotee and got everything back again with the blessings of the Lord. Similarly, those who give contributions to expand the activities of the Krishna Consciousness Movement and to accomplish its objectives will never be losers, although you might be broke. They will get their wealth back with the blessings of Lord Krishna. Yeah, maybe, maybe not. On the other side, those who collect contributions on behalf of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness should be very careful not to use even a farthing of the collection for any purpose other than the transcendental loving service of the Lord. So luckily, most of us are anyway broke, so we can give our hearts to Krishna, if that means anything, and it certainly does, because that's the ultimate purpose of giving anything to Krishna, to ultimately surrender our heart. So there's the next verse. My dear King, Bali Maharaj donated all his possessions to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vamandev, but one should certainly not conclude that he achieved his great worldly opulence in Biloswarga as a result of his charitable disposition. So his giving everything to God was not the result of him living nicely in Sutala. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the source of life for all living entities, lives within everything as a friendly super soul. And under his direction, a living entity enjoys or suffers in this material world. Greatly appreciating the transcendental qualities of the Lord, Bali Maharaj offered everything at his lotus feet. His purpose, however, was not to gain anything material, but to become a pure devotee. For a pure devotee, the door of liberation is automatically open. One should not think that Bali Maharaj was given so much material opulence merely because of his charity. When one becomes a pure devotee in love, he may also be blessed with a good material position by the will of the Supreme Lord. However, one should not mistakenly think that the material opulence of a devotee is the result of his devotional service. The real result of devotional service is the awakening of pure love for the Supreme Personality of Godhead, which continues under all circumstances. You know, in other words, it continues under all circumstances, even if you are without material opulence. That's the idea. This is important because a lot of traditions today, they do kind of propagate on the idea that by becoming dedicated to God, you'll enjoy materially. This is one of the hugest propaganda work that goes on in India, actually, for Christians. Christianity propaganda work is primarily based on this point, that if you surrender to Jesus, you'll be able to enjoy happily. So those who convert, they'll send them like televisions, help them with homes, and this way they're getting so many converts in India right now, just on this one point, that you'll enjoy materially. So Prabhupada wants to point out that this is not the result of devotional service. The result of devotional service is pure love for Krishna. And Krishna may give such devotee an opulent position, or he may not, according to, you know, his particular reciprocation and desire for that particular devotee. But whether the Lord does it or not, it doesn't matter. The devotee remains unflinching in his love for Krishna in all circumstances. I often tell I've told this many times, and I'll tell it again because I think it's funny. When I was traveling with Revatsanandana Prabhu for book distribution, he would have a cart of Lord Jagannath, like pictures of Lord Jagannath all over the cart. And when we would travel through the hallway from the red line to the blue line, it's a long hallway, and he would sing Jai Jagannath, Jai Jagannath throughout the hallway. It was very intense. And then we were going through the hallway, and we got out of the hallway, and one Christian was underneath the ground, dressed nicely in a suit, perhaps a Jehovah's Witness or something. And he said, who is that? And Revatsananda, that's Jagannath. He's very eccentric. So that's Jagannath, like Broadway or something, you know? And he said, well, what is, you know, the Supreme Lord? So he said, what has Jagannath done for you? Jesus gave me a house, gave me a good wife, gave me a good car. And he went on through a long list of material opulences. He said, and what has Jagannath done for you? And I said, he took all those things away. So that I can focus on the Supreme Lord, you know. And he was a little bit shocked by that. And Revatsananda Prabhu said, let's go, you know. Don't bother with him like this. So I think that's a little funny story. In other words, the Supreme Lord may or may not give such opulences, but that's not the point. The point is whether or not we're getting love for Krishna. Yeah. Mother Krishna has a question. You can.
Okay. How do we preach to the people who want happiness ultimately? Because I would say the majority of people are not going to be satisfied. I mean, obviously they're converting to Christianity because their hearts are not on prema bhakti and achieving that goal. So how do we elevate them? Because at least Srila Acharyadeva, he has stated that it's good that we have grihasthas, people who are working like that, because it shows people, oh, maybe I can do this. Maybe I actually have a chance at.
And in fact, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that such person is actually loved by everyone. In chapter 5 Bhagavad Gita, I've been studying chapter 4 and chapter 5 Bhagavad Gita, because those are really cool chapters. And then in chapter 5, Krishna is speaking about the karma yogi, so the person who's actually working and doing prescribed duties. And Krishna is actually intentionally, how do you say it, juxtaposing the karma yogi who's working against the renunciate, actually, that he speaks about in chapter 4. And he speaks with the karma yogi that he is also renounced internally, like the Gyan yogi, except he does work, and such a person is loved by all. Krishna actually says, Sarva Bhutatma Bhutatma, that he's actually loved by all because of this. And so certainly having such persons is very, at the bare minimum, good preaching as such. At the same time, your question, how do we elevate them from such an understanding? There has to be an appreciation of the nature of sat and asat, which is Krishna's primary basis of discussion. In the 2.16 Bhagavad Gita, he makes a point that sat, there is no change, and asat, there is no endurance. And then he builds his whole discussion basically on this one point. You know, the soul is sat, and everything else is asat, and so on. So people can be elevated unless they appreciate the nature of asat and sat against each other. So having preachers or grihasas, for example, who are nicely situated and even opulent actually serves for good preaching. At the bare minimum, serves as good preaching because people can see an example. And Krishna speaks about this all throughout the Gita, setting that example. But being spiritually situated, but setting that example. He tells Arjuna that throughout the entire Gita. So it is certainly very good. But then how to elevate such persons? Then it comes by this appreciation of the nature of a sadhana. Oh, this is actually anyway temporary. So therefore, to desire something temporary is to desire my own suffering, ultimately. And so once they get that insight, then their desires become elevated on their own course. So understanding is just so powerful. Like many devotees was asking me in London, you know, how do I improve this? How do I improve that? And I was giving the understanding just by understanding. Which didn't always serve as the most inspirational answer initially when I would say it. But I said, just by understanding, you get actually improved enthusiasm in so many things. And also your desires change on account of some new revelation of as such. Just like when you don't understand Bhagavad Gita, for example, you don't feel inspired to read it or apply it. But as soon as you get an understanding of it, then you want to go, oh, wow, this is really cool, and you feel inspiration, and that also affects your application because you're inspired and so on. So people can't be elevated without proper knowledge, in other words. So the message of Bhagavad Gita, of course, is not to artificially, you know, desire something, because that won't long endure anyway. If you don't have the proper ground of desire, which is the appreciation of asat versus asat, then that desire will not anyway long endure. I remember when I first joined, I really appreciated the idea that the devotee will go to hell to serve Krishna. I thought that was such a cool idea. The devotee is ready to go to hell. And, you know, so I was always speaking about that and my utsahamayi, you know, false enthusiasm, unfixed practice. And then after a couple of years, I kind of like thought about that one day. Like the gopis were ready to suffer eternally in hell to relieve Krishna's headache for a moment. And I heard this story many times. I thought it very beautiful until one day I actually thought about it. I was like, wait a minute. Go to hell eternally to relieve Krishna's headache from... But in the next moment he has a headache, I'm stuck up in hell for eternity, you know. And his headache is... I started, you know, the rational mind started to come through. And then as you start to actually suffer a lot from being accosted by duality and you're not actually transcendental, I found that my desire turned from not desiring to go to hell for suffering living entities, but it started turning more to like moksha. I just want to be free from all this crap. And so then I realized that such desires, you know, the pure devotional desires and so on, they were made, as long as we don't have the proper ground of understanding and realization, then such desires don't long endure also. And therefore, we don't artificially tell persons, you got prema's the only thing. Generally, we try to, as Krishna has done, try to systematically bring them up to that understanding. First at least understand there's a difference between consciousness and matter. And that understanding alone can elevate a lot of people's desires. Oh, there's a difference between consciousness and matter. And then to help suss out deeper realizations of that one point, here's yoga. Here's a yoga process to help deepen that appreciation and that understanding. Like that. As long as someone thinks they're a material object, then they will desire materially. And so if someone really appreciates that they're a spiritual entity, then their desires would be spiritual. So we need to elevate them like that. So does that cover all the elements? Okay.
Middle that that I was thinking about Asat and Sat, that understanding, how crucial it is for pretty much anybody in any situation of life.
Yes.
And, yeah, because we hear a lot of what you're saying, antagonism towards grihasthas, and I understand the point, because it's has certain opulences already built into it, that the tendency to enjoy is like incredibly, it's like hello, you know, it's like the cake's right in front of you, don't
yeah.
eat it though.
Yeah.
Like that. But I think having grihasthas, like you were pointing out, is really important for preaching, because there are people who will never take a book from a brahmachari or a book distributor or on the street or whatever. They'll continuously refuse. But if it's somebody at their job and they offer them some prasadam, but they don't know it's prasadam, they'll take it immediately. Like,
yeah.
I see that with my mom's work, my own work, so many times, you know, just becoming a friend of some employee at my job, immediately they'll take any prasadam I give them. And they'll
yes.
be like, please, can I have more? You know,
yes.
like that. So many benefits to being in those kind of positions, even though they are dangerous. But it's also dangerous to be in a brahmachari position, I think, because then you get this mentality like, I'm invincible. Or
yes.
maybe I'm more devotional. And maybe I, like you were saying, maybe I don't even have the understanding of like what does this mean when I say I'm ready to go to hell eternally
yes.
For Krishna? You know, am I really committed to that idea and that kind of suffering? So
yes.
I think, I guess I'm just trying to present the other side, that both ashrams have dangers.
Yes, well, in Kali Yuga, we should kind of appreciate that the ashram situation is really, it's kind of like we're giving a concession, so to speak. You know, Brahmachari ashram, for example, didn't feature half the brahmacharis already having various, you know, let's say, illicit affairs before joining the ashram, you know. So it's a brahmachari ashram in a, let's say, a very broad sense. And so also true of the grihastha ashram in Kali Yuga, because grihastha ashram followed proper training as a youth, as a brahmachari, and so on. So we're being very broad-minded when we say brahmachari ashram and grihastha ashram. We're being extremely broad-minded here. In order to help us give us some level of social context and interaction and so on. Like I also mentioned, the reason that we do hear a lot of, I would call it apparent antagonism towards householder existence in the shastras, is because A, most individuals will move in that direction with that information or not, you know. And B, because we have a tendency to be in illusion about what it's going to be like. And we all have that experience of like romanticizing about what it would be like, you know, have a loving companion, and it would just be music in the air and in the nice breeze. I mean, yeah, isn't it? We certainly have I can speak for myself. I certainly have that. And I remember when I was looking for love before I became a devotee, you know, maybe I saw too many movies, but you know, in the movies, it's always the right music coming in at the right moment. It's just like the best music, and then they kind of like, you know, and it's like the slow movements, and it's very attractive, and you become rather convinced that this is what it would be like. And even after hearing the opposite, the mind does not so easily accept. It's quite resilient in its imaginations of romance, etc. So therefore, the shastras, because we have the tendency to be an illusion, will speak rather disparagingly half the time, or more than half the time, about that situation. But the reality is that most individuals, despite such information, anyway will move to that condition. And therefore, you also hear the other side of the situation. Do it nicely. And, you know, be exemplary, which is the message that Krishna actually gives to Arjuna throughout the Gita. Arjuna is a grihastha man. He's a working man, and etc. And Krishna never tells him to give that up at any point in the Bhagavad Gita, whether he encourages him in that understanding. So that is, so I think the shastras do present a balanced message. And I think it's balanced because we are ourselves unbalanced, actually. We are already ourselves, by conditioning, we're already way on one other side. So then the shastras, in order to make us balanced, will speak more disparagingly about the thing. And it also speaks positively. But you will hear a lot of apparent, like I said, I call it apparent antagonism, to really kind of balance us out, because we're already way heavy on the illusion about what it's going to be. And therefore, it's a good balance. But like I said, when we say brahmachari ashram and grihastha ashram, we're being rather broad-minded, to be honest with you, in my understanding of the thing. And it helps us give some level of social context and interaction, creates somewhat of an ethos. But, you know, it has its, because it's not really the real culture, then it has a lot of problems. Like, here's an example of a problem that comes up. When a brahmachari decides to become a grihastha, the ethos that's been created in ISKCON is that it's a fall down. It automatically means fall down. If someone decides to switch over to the grihastha ashram, it's like you show up to the temple room one day with white on, and everyone's like, you know, and it's just the ethos of the place. And then someone comes up to you and says, "So Prabhu, who is she?" You know, or something like that. It's like, it's very terrible, but it's the kind of ethos that was generated in the devotee's initial days of enthusiasm, what it meant to be a brahmachari, what it meant to be a sannyasi, and what it meant to please Srila Prabhupada, we have to be renounced. And that ethos remained throughout, and it's still there even today. So much so when devotees do decide to switch. And in a traditional Varnashram culture, that's considered an elevated, you're becoming more elevated. Either there's Upakravana Brahmachari or the opposite. Upakravana Brahmachari is one, he's the one that gets married, a Brahmachari who gets married, and a Naishthiki Brahmachari. So then you graduated from Brahmachari Ashram, you either got married, so it's considered a step up in the traditional kind of cultural context, but in our cultural context, it automatically means you fell down. Oh, there was some problem and so on. So therefore, this is the problem that comes up with the ethos as we're trying to apply it in Kali Yuga today. There are many problems that are there, many levels of small-mindedness and so on. I think some of those things are slowly changing by dint of the fact that people are having to enter into these situations, etc. But I think the shastras do present a very nice balance. Like I said, because I think we're heavily unbalanced, actually, in our conditioned nature. So shastra does present a pretty good balance of it. It just depends on the speakers now, their level of understanding. Now, oftentimes, it can be seen that just like when I was in London. I'm sorry, this is funny. One devotee was giving class, and the class was just about Lord Chaitanya's taking sannyas and so on. He spoke about many things. And one older man answered, he said, "But men and women are not equal," you know. It was like a completely random statement, you know, out of nowhere. He like went on and on and on about it. And there were many, of course, Matajis were in the room also, and we were there also. And we all just started busting up laughing, because it was like there was nothing else we could do in that situation but laugh. The speaker, of course, addressed it quite heavily. But the rest of us were laughing because it was just so outrageous, because it had nothing to do with the class, and obviously he was being prompted by his own prejudices, you know, previously acquired prejudices, either ancient or recent, that he was making such a statement. So a lot of times speakers may skew a proper understanding and therefore inculcate into the hearts of people a very prejudiced idea of the ashrams, for example, since that's the point of discussion. But the shastras themselves, I think, present a very good balance. And it's just the speakers ourselves, our understanding will skew the proper presentation of shastras and so on, like that. So I'm going to finish there, because it's 8:25. Does anyone else want to say anything about the Bilo Swarga? Hopefully no one's desiring to go there or anything like that, after hearing about increased sexual prowess, etc. All right, you're all enlightened souls. Yeah, huh? That's behind in that direction.
Understand the soul is transmigrating through 8,400,000 species of life before it comes to the human birth. So is this demons and nagas a type of human birth, or is this among those 8 million?
Yes, and I mean, we can understand that we're going through all these various species. The demons and nagas also form one type of species. And so, yes, we're traveling through all of them in a broad sense. I don't know if we even need more detailed information than that. than the reality that we have moved through all these various species, probably millions of times.
Sometimes the demons is considered a higher birth
than what?
Than human beings. At least
how so?
In some descriptions of Bhagavatam, we were reading
really?
in previous chapters, even while you were here a long time back, where it was going through these different gradations of living beings. It's like above is the demigods, then there's the deities, the demons, and then there's...
Yeah, but I remember those verses always concluding in human birth, and particularly devotee birth, being the most exalted. Those types of descriptions, I always remember them concluding in that way. So we would have to search that out and see the particular descriptions. But generally it's understood that human birth is the most auspicious, more so than the upper planetary systems, what to speak of the lower planetary systems, because it gives stronger opportunity for sadhu sangha. There's a particular verse in this fifth canto that actually comes up, spoken by Jadabharata, where Jadabharata makes that point that the sadhus hardly ever go to the higher regions, which is speaking of the lower regions, and therefore human birth is most, all the devas are also desiring human birth because it affords one greater opportunity for association with saintly persons. I'm not going to be able to find this verse now. But the general idea is that human birth is actually the most auspicious. By dint of the enjoyment and suffering being not as intense, and also by dint of the increased opportunity for association with sadhus. So that's my general understanding of the gradation of species. See, if there's too much enjoyment, it's very hard to focus, and if suffering is too intense, it's also very hard to focus. So human life gives a good balance of the two.
Yeah, I guess that's why maybe we're under the impression that the lower planetary systems are hellish, because of the statement, if the suffering on the higher planets is more enjoyable than on the lower planets, the lower planets there would refer to hellish planets, not
that, so like
geographically
you said,
lower.
It seems that there's a distinction between hellish planets and the lower planets. Therefore, they're getting their own chapters, their own separate discussions. So it looks like that might have been our assumption. Like I mentioned in yesterday's class, we often come up with misunderstandings because when we hear something, we've already assumed that what we heard about meant this, but it meant something else. And then we get a misunderstanding based on our assumptions like that. So that's something we can examine later. I'll look for that verse later. It's a good verse. Yeah.
Real quick, you talk about the Nagas in the one of the planetary systems.
Mm-hmm.
Just for clarification, I was under the impression that the Nagas were considered like kings, or divine kings. Is this not so? Or
maybe.
Are they viewed as the more Asuric?
Not divine kings, though, but kings, perhaps. They're kings of their planets and so on.
Are they also, associates of Lord Shiva, because there are certain like Naga tribes that
I don't know
found in like Burloka or planet Earth.
I don't know. I'm India. Not exactly sure, and I don't care. To be honest with you, I generally tend to focus on the information that's going to help to improve my pure devotional aspirations. So those types of information, like I said yesterday, the information about the geography of the universe and so on, I hardly care about it. For me, it inspires only in the sense that it blurs the lines between what is nice in the material world, you know. Even if the demons are enjoying nicely, then, you know, but it's all material. So I take those types of messages from this discussion because that gives me firmer ground for building upon my pure devotional desires. So information about the Nagalokas and what they do there and all that, I could hardly care less about that information. But if you're really, like, really into it, we could perhaps try to examine it and so on. But as a general point that we want to take for our bhajan, our own bhajan means our own spiritual practice, that which will help us keep one point of attention on Krishna. And so we may only, in other words, I feel that even the gloss over such information is not that bad. You know, gloss may just, you know, kind of go over, you know, kind of quickly and because we want to take the information that will help us make us one-pointed in our bhajan and our desires for Krishna. Anyway, that's my particular mood. I thank you all very much for tolerating me. Srila Prabhupada ki jaya.